Okay, continuing with our Science 201. Reading Canto 2, Chapter 5, will be texts 31, 32, and 33. In 30, we heard about the mode of goodness. False ego in contact with the mode of goodness. And the language specifically is that from the mode of goodness, the mind is generated. So matter is, like, here's a microphone stand. So this is matter. And matter is influenced by the modes of nature. And according to the mode of nature that matter is influenced by, different things happen. So, pradhan, produces, when agitated by the glance of Mahavishnu, it produces false ego. False ego is now within pradhan, or matter. And then the modes also become activated by the presence of false ego. And when the mode of goodness becomes agitated by false ego, the mind is generated. And also the 10 demigods controlling bodily movements. Such demigods are known as controllers of the directions, controllers of air, sun god, the father of Prajapati, Daksha, the Ashwini Kumaras, the fire god, the king of heaven, the worshipable deity of heaven, king of the Adityas, Brahmaji, and the Prajapatis all come into existence. Prabhupada spoke a lot about bhakti, using these things in service to Krishna, as opposed to immaterial consciousness. So now, by further transformation of the mode of passion, the sense organs, so there's five and five, Jnana Shakti and Kriya Shakti, the organs of knowledge and the organs of action, Jnanendriyas and Karmendriyas. Like the ear, skin, nose, eyes, tongue, mouth, hands, genitals, legs, and outlet for evacuating. Together with intelligence and living energy are all generated. I didn't get a chance to compare this, but my memory says this is what we're hearing is described at least twice. In addition to here in the second canto, it's discussed in the third canto. In detail, as it's happening here, Lord Kapila is describing this to Devahuti, the unfolding of the elements. Lord Brahma similarly discusses earlier in the third canto, but not in exactly the same manner. So it's like two and a half times. The subject matter is covered. In Kapila's discussion, I should double check, but to to the best of my recollection, this, the manifesting of the 10 senses falls under the mode of ignorance. As, here, listen to what it, well, I'll read the purport. We'll come back to this. Purport: the living condition in material existence depends more or less on one's intelligence and powerful living energy. So there was a question yesterday, I think it was yesterday, yeah, about is the air the same thing as life air? So here very clearly, prana is generated separately and air is generated separately. So prana is being translated as powerful living energy or living energy, and is generated along with intelligence. So both intelligence and living energy are needed for material existence. Intelligence, to counteract the hard struggle for existence, is assisted by the senses for acquiring knowledge, and the living energy maintains himself by manipulating the active organs, like the hands and legs, etc. But on the whole, the struggle for existence is an exertion of the mode of passion. So all of that makes sense. Therefore, all the sense organs, headed by intelligence and the living energy, prana, are different products and byproducts of the second mode of nature called passion. Another place where this is discussed indirectly is in the final section of Canto 4 under the King Paranjan story. There's a city of 9 gates, and within the city of 9 gates there's a serpent. The serpent is life air, and different generals. You know, the knowledge, there's 10 knowledge acquiring and the Gyanendriyas. So, Karmendriyas and Gyanendriyas, like here. And then there's the king and the queen. The king is the soul and the queen is material intelligence. Because you have to have material intelligence to have material existence, because material intelligence figures out how to do it, have material existence. And yeah, in that allegory, sometimes the city is attacked, so the king requires his generals and the serpent to protect when the city is attacked. Then he talks about death when the generals and the serpent are overwhelmed. Life energy is overwhelmed, and the knowledge acquiring senses and the working senses thereby also become overwhelmed, and the city is sieged, and the king and queen are taken away. In that description, it's very clear, as with Kapila Dev's description, what's not being spoken about is the physical manifestation of hands or ears. It's not like there's a big warehouse of hands and ears and noses. You just, you know, I'll take this nose and that ear. But it's rather, it's subtle senses. As in pratyahara, in the yoga process, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara. In the pratyahara stage, the senses are withdrawn. It's not, you know, your ears go inside your head and your nose goes inside your face and your eyes go turn around backwards. What it means is the subtle sense is in its, in the material consciousness, it's going out into the field of activity. So in the yogic process, that going out is withdrawn within. It's not even just kind of hanging out dormant, anesthetized or something. It's withdrawn within. The senses are directed within. So it's the subtle sense. The explanation in the purport, Prabhupada is going to 2-3 times make a comparison between motor parts. So supposing you have a car and the headlight, one of the headlights goes out. What do? You go to a car parts place, you buy another headlight, take the old one out, put the new one in, and off you go. You have two headlights. Or your alternator goes bad. You go to a parts store, you buy an alternator, and take out the old alternator and put in a new alternator. And zoom, zoom, off you go. So there are gross senses, and then there's subtle senses. Because there's subtle senses, it means you can change parts of the machine and it still works. But you need both. You need the gross senses and the subtle sense. Like, you know, somebody goes blind. So theoretically it's possible to change the eye, because the subtle sense, provided the subtle sense is still operative, you just need the instrument for seeing, one that works, because the subtle sense is there. Modern science, modern medicine, on one hand, understands, you know, that the seeing is not actually taking place at the instrument of the eye. They think it's taking place at the instrument of the brain through electrochemical impulses that go to the brain. Then the brain is doing the seeing. And if there's brain damage, and then, you know, even the good instrument isn't going to work, because that capacity for, this is their way of looking at it. You have to have both a good brain and a good lens, or a good senses. The Vedic model is quite different. The brain is also part of that machine. And then there's the subtle sense. So what I gather here is what's being described, this mode of passion, is that the subtle sense and the gross mode of ignorance manifests the gross sense through matter, through air, fire, water, and earth. The element, the object of perception, and the instrument of sense perception, the gross instrument. And here is describing, it seems, the subtle. Now, Prabhupada says something, this last sentence of the purport has me puzzled. So if you ask me, what does this mean? The reply will be, I'm not sure what this means. Here's the statement. This mode of passion, however, is a product of the air element as described before. This mode of passion, so the mode of passion that unfolds into the sense organs, intelligence, and living energy, is a product of the air element. My sense is that the modes of nature are not active as long as the living entity is not active. But when Mahavishnu glances and the living energy, the soul, starts to become active, then the modes of nature in contact with a false ego separates out these different things. The mode of nature is inherently there. But here it's specifically saying the mode of passion, however, is the product of the air element as described before. The only reference that even remotely makes some sense is from a few verses previous. It says, because the sky is transformed, the air is generated with the quality of touch, and by previous succession, the air is also full of sound and the basic principles of duration of life. Sense perception, mental power, and bodily strength. That's the only remote, because as Prabhupada has said in this purport, the struggle for existence is an exertion of the mode of passion, and it has these two divisions. Sense perception which is a product of air, and bodily strength. Life energy. Because Prabhupada doesn't explain it, in the purport there's this direct statement in the verse. There's no reference to the mode of passion, but I'll just read it again. Because the sky is transformed, the air is generated with the quality of touch, and by previous succession, the air is also full of sound, and the basic principles of duration of life, sense perception, mental power, and bodily strength. Now, mental power, mind is generated separately. The mind is generated by the mode of goodness in contact with, or the mode of the false ego in contact with the mode of goodness. There's the mind, and then there's mental power. There's the senses, and there's sensual strength. Sense perception. And there's the active organs, and then there's bodily strength. So the bodily strength, the sense perception, this is the mode of passion. The instruments are the mode of ignorance. So that's the best I can do with that statement. It doesn't indicate at all that these are chronological. It just is all it for sure is saying is that cause and effect. Doesn't say when. It may be all happening at this, you know, at the same time, like an explosion or something. Or it might be a chain reaction. This and then this and then this and then this, as in cause and effect. Doesn't indicate that. You can write a book on these things, but it's a short purport instead. So, intelligence to counteract the hard struggle for existence is assisted by the senses for acquiring knowledge, and the living energy maintains himself by manipulating the active organs like the hands and legs. But on the whole, the struggle for existence is an exertion of the motive passion. Therefore, all the sense organs, headed by the intelligence and the living energy, prana, are different products and byproducts of the second motive nature called passion. This motive passion, however, is a product of the air element, as described before. It's quite subtle, isn't it? It could also imply a chain reaction kind of thing. Not exactly a cause and effect, but when this happens, when the mode of ignorance unfolds sky, and sky unfolds air, that may like cause a chain reaction. Okay, air has touch, and at the same time the mode of passion becomes activated. Where in order to have touch, you have to have the instrument. So, boom, boom, the instrument of the sense for acquiring the knowledge of touch, the subtle sense. Anyway. O Narada, it would be very helpful to compare exactly what's written here in the second canto with the Kapila Dev description in the third canto, and see how, you know, hold this one up to that one and see how a little information is disclosed here, a little information is disclosed there. How do the two match? I'm sure there's symmetry. Text 32. O Narada, best of the transcendentalists, the forms of the body cannot take place as long as these created parts, namely the elements, senses, mind, and modes of nature, are not assembled. Purport. So Prabhupada speaks about car factories assembling motor parts. The different types of bodily construction of the living entities are exactly like different types of motor cars, manufactured by assembling the allied motor parts. When the car is ready, the driver sits in the car and moves it as he desires. This is also confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, 1861. The living entity is as if seated on the machine of the body, and the car of the body is moving by the control of material nature, just as railway trains are moving under the direction of the controller. He doesn't say that it's moving under the direction of the driver of the car. He says moving under the direction of material nature, which is what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. The living entities, however, are not the bodies. They are separate from the car of the body. But the less intelligent material scientist cannot understand the process of assembling the parts of the body, namely, the senses, the mind, and the qualities of the material modes. Every living entity is a spiritual spark, part and parcel of the Supreme Being. And by the kindness of the Lord, the Father is kind to his sons, for the Father is kind to his sons. The individual living beings are given a little freedom to act according to their will, to lord it over material nature. Just as a father gives him playthings to the crying child to satisfy him, the whole material creation is made possible by the will of the Lord to allow the bewildered living entities to lord it over things as they desire, although under the control of the agent of the Lord. The living entities are exactly like small children, playing the material field under the control of the maid servant of the Lord, that is, nature. They accept Maya, or the maid servant, as all in all, and thus wrongly conceive of the Supreme Truth to be feminine, parentheses, goddess, Durga, etc. The foolish, childlike materialists cannot reach beyond the conception of the maid servant, material nature. But the intelligent grown-up sons of the Lord know well that all acts of material nature are controlled by the Lord, just as a maidservant is under the control of the master, the father of the undeveloped child. Paragraph. The parts of the body, such as the senses, are the creation of the Mahatattva. And when they are assembled by the will of the Lord, the material body comes into existence and the living entity is allowed to use it for further activities. This is explained as follows. So, that the Mahatattva is now said to be the place of creation, whereas before, the language is the modes of nature produces. So it's not exactly the mode of nature produces, as meaning like out of nothing. But the mode of nature in contact with nature. The mode, the guna, in contact with nature produces. So Mahatattva produces, agitated by the presence of false ego and the time energy. And we know that nature alone does not produce things. When we say everything is carried out, when Krishna says everything is carried out by material nature, we're not the doer, everything is carried out by material nature. But nature doesn't just do things on her own. Behind there's the touch of spirit. And even the touch of spirit, behind the touch of spirit is the Supreme. So that's the next sentence. Remote cause. We can say Mahatattva creates, we can say the mode of nature in contact with false ego produces. But to have the complete picture, the Supreme Personality of Godhead produces. That's text 33. Thus, when all these become assembled by force of the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this universe certainly came into being. By accepting both the primary and secondary causes of creation. That the language primary and secondary causes of creation is explained in the final paragraph. That is, there's the creation of all the universes and then the detailed creation of each universe. Here's the paragraph. There are two modes of material creation. The creation of the collective universes, as stated above, done by Mahavishnu, and the creation of the single universe. Mahavishnu generates the multiple universes, which is described in the purport. They float on the causal ocean. He then expands as Garbhadakshay Vishnu, who then expands each of the universes. And he does the detailed work through the agency of Lord Brahma. Both are done by the Lord, and thus the universal shape, as we can see, takes place. This verse is just helping us to remember where this discussion started from, lest we lose our Krishna consciousness in the course of studying material nature and all these different things popping up here and there. There's a remote cause. Without the remote cause, things don't pop up anywhere. Same Prakriti, same modes of nature, same living entity, nothing happens. Without the primary and secondary causes of creation. Purport. In this verse, it is clearly mentioned that the Supreme Personality of Godhead exerts his different energies, because the word in the verse is Bhagavat Shakti Chodita, being applied. Bhagavat Shakti Chodita. He applies his different energies. It is not that he himself is transformed into material creations. Prabhupada's example, here's a piece of paper. Take the piece of paper, rip the piece of paper into little pieces, and then distribute the little pieces. So now we have little pieces all over the floor. The original paper is gone because it's material. So the teaching of the Bhagavatam is Shakti Parinama Vad, or Parinama is transformation. The energies of Krishna become transformed, which is exactly what we heard, all this transforming into this, into that. It's energies of Krishna transforming. That's what creation is. And during the period of manifestation, it's just energies transforming. So, material life is wishing and applying ourselves to get a transformation of energy that is our liking, according to our mode of nature. We like this one. Somebody likes that one. So we have varieties of life and varieties of ways of living. But it's nothing but the different energies of the Lord being transformed. It does not happen without his directing his energies or sanctioning his energies in varieties of ways. And it's not that he gets lost. All there is the Shakti. And as the Shakti transforms, then the original is lost. It's not like that. Om Purnamadak Purnamidam, in other words. He expands himself by his different energies as well as by his plenary portions. Then he describes the plenary portions. In a corner of the spiritual sky of Brahmajyoti, a spiritual cloud sometimes appears, and the covered portion is called the Mahatattva. The Lord then, by his plenary portion as Mahavishnu, lies down within the water of the Mahatattva. And the water is called the causal ocean, or Karana Jala. While Mahavishnu sleeps within the causal ocean, innumerable universes are generated along with his breathing. These universes are floating, and they are scattered all over the causal ocean. They stay only during the breathing period of Mahavishnu. That is, when he inhales, they're all gone. There they are. They're gone. He has a long breathing period. In each and every universal globe, the same Mahavishnu enters as Garbhadaksha Vishnu and lies there in the serpentine Shesha incarnation. From his navel sprouts a lotus stem, and on the lotus, Brahma, the Lord of the universe, is born. Brahma creates all forms of living beings of different shapes in terms of different desires within the universe. He also creates the sun, moon, and other demigods. Now, we are just hearing that Brahma creates the sun, moon, and other demigods, but we, a moment ago, heard that from the mode of goodness, the mind is generated and becomes manifest, and also the 10 demigods controlling bodily movements. And among the demigods, Brahmaji is mentioned as one of them. Sounds a little circular. And so, the only thing that I can gather, I can speculate, is there are personalities that fill the post, and there's the post. So the creation of Vishnu is he creates the post. And then someone fills it. And then Brahma is the one that he establishes somebody in that post, the sun post and the moon post and other demigods, the controlling personalities of the universe. There's a paragraph with two sentences. Therefore, the chief engineer of the material creation is the Lord himself, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 9:10. It is he only who directs the material nature. 9:10 is Maya Dyakshina Prakriti. It is he only who directs material nature to produce all sorts of moving and non-moving beings. So he has agents that help him. He has Brahma, and from Brahma, demigods and so on, controlling agents. So that's the sarga and visarga. There's the sub-creation, the creation by the Lord, and the sub-creation by Lord Brahma. He just fills in the detail. It's already there. The plan is there in its subtle feature. And he just fills in the slots. It sounds pretty simple, but the complexity of material nature is awesome. So the intelligence of Brahma is awesome. I mean, I have a little video that was put together by the intelligent design people, and there are scientists that are describing their lifelong dedication to study the flagella of an E. coli bacteria. I mean, 35 years of studying the machine parts of an E. coli bacteria. I wonder what he's going to become in his next life. But their conclusion after all of that study is, there's somebody that made all these machine parts. You know, the Darwinian conception that says it all happened by laws of nature over time. There's only one thing, matter and the laws governing matter. And over a period of time, this little E. coli bacteria got himself together. By amino acids combining in certain ways to make proteins, and the proteins combining in certain ways, just by chance, evolving over a period of time. So by their 30, 35 years of study under, you know, electronic, whatever you call it, electro microscopes, taking pictures of the bodily parts of a flagella, of an E. coli bacteria, there's 33 different parts. Minus any one of them, it doesn't work. And they have to come together in a sequence. It's like, you know, it's very much like the manufacturing of some machine. If some part is put in before another part in a wrong order, it won't work. Not just a matter, and where did all the parts come from? They make a compelling argument from detailed study of that this single-celled little living entity that has a little tail that moves. But the tail that moves, they've studied it to say that it moves in a circular motion, and it can go in reverse motion in a microsecond, and the number of times it moves per second is like, you know, thousands of times. It's like a high-speed propeller. And it can move the opposite direction in a flash. You know, it doesn't even need a brake time, just psh, psh. So it has, you know, and they have names for the different parts of the machine. And there's different kinds of amino acids that create different proteins that are needed for the different parts. Not even, they're all of the same protein. But there's different amino acids. So how does it all come together? So then they go back further and say, you know, where do you get the proteins from? Then they have this whole thing of, through video animation, they take you inside the nucleus of a cell, through a little pore, I forget what the thing is called. And then there's the DNA strand that's inside the nucleus of the cell. And by a process, I can't remember the name of the process, it reproduces, it takes, a machine part comes in through the hole, takes one of those strands, it recreates it, takes it over, takes it out of the hole again to another machine part, another machine that gathers together the right amino acids in the right sequence and puts it all together and makes another strand that goes off somewhere, a protein that goes off somewhere in the cell that does something that the cell needs. And the way, you know, it's very artfully done. It's exactly, I showed this at UCLA once, and the person that saw it, one of the persons that saw it, it was a devotee, he said, you know, I just taught that my microbiology class. You know, so she's a PhD, and she's teaching microbiology. What I showed in that video is, she said, it's exactly what I taught my graduate students in class this morning. What I was showing in the little video in the evening. Just, I never saw it displayed in such a nice, attractive way by video animation. So, in other words, the narrator of the video is saying, this is exactly like a machine. Excuse me, like a factory. You know, where do you get the ingredients from? You get your supplier that gives you the ingredients. You bring the ingredients to a machine that produces what you want, and you send it off to do something. And there is, all of this is going on within a single cell. And it all happened by chance. Do you say factories happened by chance? Just the right ingredient? You know, you get one little amino acid that's not in the right order, and it doesn't do the job. Doesn't make the right protein. And how is all of that determined? It's determined by the coding that's in the DNA. How did all that information get in the DNA? They make the comparison. Does Bill Gates just get, you know, software programs without intelligent software programmers? Without design? Just like, you know, go there and you're, come out of the office and you have a software program. And there's just nothing inside but matter and randomly interacting. That's not how it happens. It takes intelligence. It's their intelligent design argument. At any level you want to go. How the thing unfolds, how the elements are put together to make what you want, you know, the intelligence of Lord Brahma. But where, and then you go back, where does the intelligence of Lord Brahma come from? Where do the ingredients come from? There's the remote cause. You just say, no, it's just matter randomly interacting with other chunks of matter, and it produces a flagella of an E. coli bacteria, and it gets proteins coming together from amino acids. That's how it happened. Not a plausible picture of things. But by cause and effect, yes, certain amino acids put together make proteins. Now, how did it happen? So the Bhagavatam has its depiction. The element of material intelligence is needed. And behind that material intelligence is the remote cause, without which you don't have universes, you don't have life. So the creation depiction is far more complete and plausible and satisfying than the simpler one that says God created heaven and earth in 7 days. Whoops, it was 6 days, and the seventh day he rested. So on the basis of that idea, there's a holy day where you, like in the Jewish faith, They don't work. There's certain things that they're not to do on Saturday, the Sabbath, the holy day, based upon that teaching from the Old Testament. Okay. I hope everything's very clear now. Any questions? Yes.
What is the primary reason why scientists don't accept God even after knowing all this? Is it because they want their own recognition, or they don't want to accept something which they don't see? Or?
Well, no. It goes back to why have they come to the material world to begin with? There are some scientists that do accept God. There's a lot of scientists that don't. There's, besides the scientists that don't, there's a lot of people that don't. And what's behind it? Here's your question. You read it. It's the spirit of wishing to be Lord. And in order for us to be Lord, he who is Lord has to disappear. If you want to be the prime minister, whoever's the prime minister has to, like, you know, get out of that seat so you can sit in that seat. Or whatever, some post. So they're very ambitious in their God project. As far as they're concerned, you don't need God, because everything happens by laws of nature. So God just disappears. So I can go into my laboratory and I can create, like, you know, I'm working on it. I'm working on creating life. I've got the building blocks of life now. So it's enviousness of God. That's where it's coming from. Fundamental.
So that means I'm interested in material science because I am.
No.
A lot of it.
No. No. Let's go back to the time of Sir Isaac Newton. He and others of his time, they were priests, and they felt, as priests were the Brahmins, were the, you know, intellectuals of our time, and leading people to the path of God, so we should use our intellectual capacity to see how nature works, and thereby show people, demonstrate to people, here's how great God is. That was the initial inspiration. So that you're attracted to material, to science, is attracted to wanting to understand the creation of God. And it can be a theistic or it can be an atheistic approach. The atheistic approach is explicitly put God where he belongs, out of the picture, out of existence. This notion of God is for weak-minded people. In fact, there is no God. Everything can be explained by, and they're dead convinced. Look at the progress that we've made in science. Just by, you know, not by depending upon God, but by the push and pull of the laws of nature, cause and effect. So as soon as we discover the cause and effect of things in a more refined manner, this notion of God disappears. We don't need him. It's for people that are weak-minded and don't have the capacity that we have to understand the push-pull of the laws of nature. There is no God. They're convinced. When you hear them speak or read what they write, they have conviction in what they're up to. They also have like a mission. You know, put God out of existence. They're competitors. They see themselves as that, in that way. God is ignorance. You know, the thought of God's existence is ignorance. Because real knowledge is there isn't any God. And that's their worldview. So that you have some attraction for science doesn't mean that, or anyone that has attraction for science, that means they're an atheist. There's a group of theists that are fighting the atheists. In the scientific community. And not a lightweight struggle. They got a hold of each other's jugular vein. The ones that are ruling right now, like by far, are the atheists. By far. Okay? Anything else? Yes?
I wonder, reading from not wrong from all of these, where Prabhupada writes that living entity may sometimes be put in a very dormant stage, like a tree or even a stone. Is it possible that soul is there in inner, in the matter, like stone and other?
Yeah. Souls are everywhere. Yeah, souls are everywhere. Souls are everywhere. Sarvakata, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. You do it the other way around. Is there any place that souls cannot exist and do not exist? No. Think of the most, you know, even if, even this situation, that situation, yeah. The state of consciousness may be more, may be very dormant. The state of consciousness may be more evolved. But souls are everywhere. Should be surprising. Different states of consciousness. Here's a real far out one. In just before the passing of Haridas Thakur, there's a discussion described in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Haridas is unable to complete his chanting. So Mahaprabhu comes and tells him, you don't, Haridas, you're a perfected soul. You don't need to chant anymore. You have to keep the same vow. He said, I have to keep my vow. I've given a vow. I can't break a vow because I'm old now. And he starts glorifying Lord Chaitanya. And one of the ways that he glorifies Lord Chaitanya is saying that you've appeared in this world to deliver all the conditioned souls, all the moving and non-moving living beings. And just by your presence, you've delivered them. And Lord Chaitanya says, Haridas, consider carefully what you're saying. Look around. We see all of life is going on. There's trees and people and beasts and all forms of life. And Haridas says, it's true. I'll explain myself. All those living entities have been sent back to Godhead and others have come to take their place. It's true. You have delivered all the conditioned souls just by your appearing in this world. Oh, that there's no shortage of living entities. You know, that some people make the argument, well, if there's a constant number of spirit souls, and there are not new ones coming into being, then how come the world population is increasing so much? And those are, so a simple answer is, those are souls in a human body. What about the places that they inhabit? Like, you know, this house, before this house existed, how many living entities were here on this plot of land? Insects, birds, trees, plants, animals. How many? The same number as live in this same space? They got displaced. Some others took their place. So, yes. Even in the most obscure places that you might want to think of, souls are everywhere. Souls are in fire. Souls are in water. Souls are in the air. Souls are everywhere. Souls are in rocks. And where they're, where they're growing, there can also be bodies just like, you know, you can see a dead insect body. And that, you know, that because there's a body there doesn't mean that there's a soul within that body. At least, you know, a more evolved soul. that the dead body, after a time, it decomposes. So where there's life, the symptoms of life, we know that there's the presence of the soul. So mountains that grow, you know, the material scientists have their idea of mountains that are expanding. It's, you know, just by physical forces. That's how they describe it. But behind those physical forces, matter doesn't move on its own. Matter is moved by the touch of spirit. Yeah, that's what it means. Like, you know, an elephant is a body of a living entity. And a mountain is a body of a living entity. So those that are growing, there are some mountains that aren't. Like, you know, the dead insect. You got something cooking over there? Okay. Anything else? Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.